Welcome. This is session 325, Being Born, Dying, Being Born Again, and Again, Learning to Love Others on Their Terms. Our presenter today will be Julie Mountier Hawker. She has an MA in Communication Studies from San Jose State University. She's a mother of four. She teaches public speaking and other communication courses at San Jose State University in California. And our respondent will be Sonia Farnsworth, who also has an MA in Communication Studies from San Jose State University and teaches Propaganda Studies and Communication Theory at Henley Putnam University and the University of Phoenix. She's the author of Mormonism's Odd Couples, The Priesthood Motherhood Connection, an essay that appears in Maxine Hank's feminist anthology, Women in Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism, and has published two articles in Sunstone Magazine. She currently resides in Salt Lake City with her husband, Davis. So,
thank you. I want everybody to look at Sonia right here. I love Sonia. I could not have gotten through graduate school without her. She tutored me, she helped me write papers, she was brilliant, she was generous, she lent me 1,000 books, and she was there for me when I needed her. She and I hold different views about Mormonism. I am a conservative, Orthodox Mormon, and even though there are cultural tendencies within the church that I don't always agree with, I do remain one of those true blue Mormons. Thus, I'm not here to argue about whether Mormon doctrine or leadership is oppressive. My story is about my duty that I owe to God in learning to love unconditionally other people. Sonia feels differently about the church than I do, and that's okay with me. I'm not here to argue and debate with her. I don't think she's here for that reason either. We're all here to discuss our personal journeys and our own individual pain. All of us in this room, I think, are on the same journey, learning to love our enemies, learning to love those who have hurt us, whether they be within the parameters of Mormonism, whether they be our political or social or economic opposites. Okay. April 1997, losses. Don't cry. Whatever you do, don't cry, I think to myself. Concentrate. Breathe. I show strength and courage, though feeling neither. Don't push, not yet. Breathe. Stay calm, focus, be brave. I reassure myself that I am not the first, nor will I be the last, to suffer this process, this loss. I'm almost through it. It hurts. Lord, help me. It hurts so much. Can't somebody ease my pain? No, no pushing. Hold off. You knew there'd be pain, Julie. You knew it coming in here. I vomit as the contractions intensify. I'm awash in unrelenting pangs of anger, mine and theirs. I long for their approval. Don't be afraid of their faces. Advises the Old Testament, but you know, I am. Their hostile words assault my senses. I vomit again. Can't they see I'm hurting? Stay calm. Listen to them. Breathe. Don't push back. Not yet. Another painful contraction. Another loss of increasing magnitude. Joseph Smith's visions. He must have been on drugs, jokes a nurse sitting next to me. Anger. I'm always angry about my pain and about my loss. And afraid. Don't panic. More intense, more fearful, more loss. Polygamy. There's no defense for that one. Breathe. Mormons do speak of it publicly in almost apologetic tones, like the crazy aunt in the basement. Who wants to acknowledge, let alone embrace it? The contractions swell, then peak, as the doctor jokingly refers to Angel Moroni's appearance to Joseph Smith. Wielding a sword, Moroni threatens to cut off Smith's genitals unless he submits to this religious doctrine. Laughter erupts. I looked at the shocked faces of the midwives. Oh, ouch, groan. I grasp at verbal straws. Another loss. They whisper and stare at me. I feel like the crazy aunt in the basement. I writhe in misery. A midwife speaks to me in demanding tones. How could you be a part of an institution that is so anti-woman? I knew it. Women in the priesthood. She has a point. This is a feminist studies course. Please, Lord, give me the words to say. I took Lamaze classes, but it didn't prepare me for this. Still, I know what comes next. What's the Mormon stance on homosexuality? Yep. My response only increases their anger. Gasps. Glares. Another loss. I'm declared a homophobe. I watched the clock. Almost 3 hours now. This birthing process, or is it rebirth, takes time. As a graduate student working toward a master's degree in communication studies, the agony is at times unbearable. My birthing center, San Jose State University, a bastion of higher learning and rational thought, a safe environment in the name of free speech and free exchange of ideas, so they claim. Why then do I feel relegated to the mental ward? Isolation, another loss. These doctors, professors, patients, students, they're all spawned from the same seed, these self-appointed vanguards of tolerance and diversity. Yeah, right. They brag about being born again, free from the confining wounds of isms, racism, sexism, classism, heterosexism. I'm born again, too. Illegitimately, according to them, born again in a religious context is shameful compared to their secular rebirths. Add another loss to the pile. I argue for viability and legitimacy. I am an underdog. I'm the only Mormon conservative in the master's program, and I know they love underdogs. Pant, push. Midwives instruct me to leave Mormonism. Another loss. I continue my posturing and tell them that Mormons are a minority. Minority status is emblematic in their secular religion. Ease my pain, won't you? The nurses aren't buying it. I play the victim card, informing them of the extermination order against Mormons. Victims do make strange bedfellows. I do know that. Surely they'll invite me in. The midwives do understand the need for the extermination order. I take comfort in my suffering. I'm certain that in giving birth, I'm simultaneously being born into martyrdom. I'm in good company. Abinadi, Stephen, Paul. The patronizing clucking of the nurses interrupts my fantasy. I loathe San Jose State. What kind of McCarthyistic birthing place is this? I look around for my Saturday's warrior sword. I never leave home without it. Easing my pain, I juxtapose my righteousness against their wickedness. Surely God is pleased with me. After all, I am his instrument. Suffering is my badge of honor, my temple recommend, proof of my sainthood. 10 minutes left of this miserable class, I get ready to push. One of the things we've talked about during the semester is a principle called emancipatory oppression. And this is Professor Wenxu Li of San Jose State University. She was the one that coined this phrase. And she talks about how any group that has been formally victimized constantly needs to reexamine itself to see if it, in turn, becomes the oppressor. So even though it can be formally have been a victim of oppression, the same group can then unknowingly start to oppress others who are different than them. Well, obviously, these menacing midwives don't see the paradox. In their zeal to emancipate me from the oppressive, patriarchal womb of Mormonism, they are blind in their own oppression of me. Determined I stay on my birthing stool. The feminist midwives are impervious, demanding compliance to their brand of midwifery. Those condescending hags. I, too, am woman. Push hard. The spiritual seed, fertilized with secular knowledge, has fully matured and begins to emerge. I contradict and use what I thought was brilliant argumentation of emancipatory oppression, and I turned the tables on them. And I compared this to giving birth and becoming a new creature in Christ, like the Book of Mormon says. We must all become new creatures. So not only was I giving birth to this new creature in Christ, I was simultaneously being born again into sainthood. Well, the nurses, the midwives, they couldn't respond to this when I accused them of oppressing me in the name of trying to emancipate me. Their hypocrisy was exposed. They stay silent. But they refused to look at my new creature as legitimate. Class is over. The midwives and nurses leave. A few of them apologize and attempts to bind my postpartum wounds. It doesn't matter, though, because I am the oppressed martyr mother, and I feel vindicated, relieved, and ensconced in motherly virtue. But a gay nurse, he tells me, he says, I admire how you hold so close to your faith, but at the same time, you try to be so open-minded. Yes, I hide my pain and bitterness well. But when he said that to me, a small kernel of compassion, it did. It ignited this irresistible force in me. I began to love him and the dreadful midwives and even the quacky doctors because I could see that this gay man understands my birthing struggle, my pain, my isolation, probably more than I could ever imagine. He doesn't know that I know he's gay. He's still in the closet. And it occurred to me that he was afraid to come out because of midwives like me. Me, a midwife? Regardless of my membership in a religion that to him is homophobic, he extends to me a form of acceptance. But I don't get it. My rebirth was just completed. I thought I achieved sainthood. And nervously, I start to question the legitimacy of my own new creature. Is it truly sired in Mormon doctrine? Is it possible that this gay man perceives Mormons and me as emancipatory oppressors? Do I unknowingly victimize others with my own brand of midwifery? I look back on all my missionary efforts and trying to redeem lost souls. I thought I had lovingly interacted with them. And then I think, well, it was for their own good. It was Christ-like love, but it wasn't. The pain starts to well up in me again, an unfamiliar pain, because clarity creeps in. I think I'm one of those hateful midwives, and I begin to die. The rest of my paper, and I'll just talk real fast. I want to give Sonia her time. Death is birth, and I am now grateful that I was willing to give birth and to die. I now teach at San Jose State, and I've become good friends with those midwives and those doctors. Even though they're still my political opposites, I've learned to connect with them. And you know what? I think they love me too. Psychologist Scott Peck, who wrote The Road Less Traveled, he validates this death-birth experience and that we all must go through, no matter what the circumstance. He says this lifetime is a series of simultaneous deaths and births. Throughout the whole of life, one must continue to learn to live. But what will amaze you even more is that throughout life, one must learn to die. The more births one will experience, and therefore the more deaths, thus the more joy and the more pain. So what happens then is my story begins in death. It's conceived in fear, certainty, isolation, self-righteousness, dogmatism, but loss piled up on loss begat anger, awareness, self-examination, grief, wisdom, grace, humility, acceptance, and then eventual unconditional love. So like I said earlier, maybe we can all relate in some way to the twisted, distressed birthing process of spiritual growth, which spawns the painful discovery of unconditional love. Born of God, changed from their carnal and fallen state, and thus we become new creatures in Christ. So I liken this this dying process to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's book titled On Death and Dying. And she says that people who have been told by their doctors that who have terminally illnesses and have only a few months to live, she said they go through five stages when they learn about their impending death. First, denial, then anger, then bargaining with God or whoever, then depression, and then finally acceptance that they are going to die. And denial, I was in my own denial, in my spiritual death, and that's what slowed my birthing process and my dying process as a result was this denial. I was so entrenched in my own ideology and victim status at San Jose State, and believe me, I was victimized, but I was in total denial to my own oppressive tendencies and how I victimized others. It's easy to be a victim, but it's really hard to realize that, gee, we could be a victimizer. Most groups are this way. We're so focused on feeling victimized that we just assume we're incapable of victimizing others. It was 2 years at San Jose State before I understood my oppression toward non-members and my political opposites. Maybe there are some of you in this room who feel oppressed by Mormonism and church leadership and Mormon doctrine, and that is painful. We all have legitimate pain, but here's the hard part. Do perhaps we oppress Orthodox Mormons in any way because of our pain? And it's thinking, our knee-jerk response is, no way, they oppress us, they victimize us. But it's really hard to look inward and look at our own oppressive tendencies because we all have them in one form or another. The second stage, anger. I was so angry for so long at San Jose State. I demanded my right to be heard in class. I wrote letters to the editor of this university newspaper. I would whine about the injustices and the hypocrisy, and I'd go to my ward at church every Sunday, and anybody who gave me a sympathetic ear, I would just and whine. And so I don't judge myself too harshly, though, because this transformation was so painful. But I also realized that I learned to look at non-members, and I didn't even realize I was doing this, that the reason I couldn't love them and totally accept them was because the bottom line was, in my book, I had the truth, I had Mormonism, you don't, therefore, you're wrong, I'm right, end of argument. And again, I didn't realize that was my thinking at the time, but I think all of us have that, again, that same kind of tendency, that fear of being wrong. Stage three, bargaining. I bargained with my opponents at San Jose State. If they treated me with tolerance and fair play, I would respond in kind. If they ignored my rules and became combative, then I would fight right back, trying to expose their hypocrisy in terms of tolerance and diversity, but all the while being clueless as to my own hypocrisy in terms of refusing to love them with Christ-like love. I did finally decide to pray about it because I was so miserable, so unhappy, and it was pure revelation. The Lord told me, you need to learn to love these people. Stop trying to win their minds and start trying to win their hearts. And I thought, are you kidding? Be friends with those jerks? But Scott Peck says, love is willful. It's hard work. It requires lots of discipline, self-examination, and a willingness to step out of your box and truly listen to others on their terms. And so that's what I did. And gradually these people responded back. And so I tried really hard to put my own defenses, my own fears aside, my own need to be right. I put it aside, and I started to listen to them. Stage four, depression. And sometimes these stages overlap. My anger eventually turned into depression, and 6 weeks before I was to graduate with my MA, I fell into this horrible depression. I went to see a doctor because I was feeling so sad, so beaten, and so tired. And he goes, Julie, he got me on antidepressants, and he said, take these. Keep taking these until you graduate. Scott Peck says, everyone wants to be loved, but in order to do this, we have to make ourselves lovable. And that's what I had to do, make myself lovable to these other people. And we do this by becoming ourselves loving. I learned that I could not emancipate people and be mean to them at the same time. And I always thought, well, but the ends justifies the means. If I have to be mean, oh well, they provoked me and I'm righteous and that's the way it is. But I learned that no, that's at odds with Christ-like love. People also don't like being told they're wrong, but they do respond to acceptance and validation. Last stage, acceptance. For me, acceptance means happiness. I accept others on their terms, not mine, which breeds love, which breeds happiness. I feel a dignity that comes with active peacemaking. I no longer just dismiss the left as wicked or wrong, just different. It took me years to understand that people on the left feel the same type of righteous zeal for their cause as I do mine. I no longer frame people within my ethical paradigm because that always falls short. If I compared non-members and had an ethical paradigm that I expected them to live by, of course they're going to fall short because their ethical paradigm is different than mine. And so that, again, was a barrier to love. My acceptance eventually evolved into genuine love. I still hold to my values, but that's what makes it even harder now when I disagree with people. It's easy to hate people that you don't know, but when we make ourselves vulnerable to love others and accept them on their terms, see them as they see themselves, we risk being vulnerable to them. And thus disagreement is all the more painful. And I can only imagine how painful the Civil War must have been, because this country had so many things in common, and it was literally families fighting against families. So that's why it's easier to hold people back at bay, because then it's easier to hate them or, you know, just disagree with them. Becoming intimate with one's enemies humanizes them, thus leaving us vulnerable to loving them. Let me just end with this. What I've learned, too, is fear is the strongest obstacle to love. Fear of being wrong, fear of being vulnerable, fear of self-analysis, fear of change, fear of interacting with the enemy. And I learned, I slogged in that mud pit with my enemies at San Jose State, and I learned to see them as they see themselves. And I learned to understand their ideas of oppression, their ideas of redemption. And I learned to have an odd but genuine respect for their views. In working and interacting with them, I love them.
Before I begin my paper, I just wanted to say I'm very proud of myself, because when I first met Julie and we got to know each other, I saw in her a kind of true grit. I knew that if there was a problem, I sensed that she would work through it, crawling across, if she had to park, crawl across a parking lot on, let's say, ground glass, she would get there. And I think that I got a sense in this paper that was what she had to do to get to the point at which she got. And so, because I was right, I'm really proud of myself, and congratulations to you, Julie, for making me look good. Julie's essay brings back vivid memories of our time together as graduate students in the Department of Communication Studies at San Jose State. Our mutual link to a weird religion defined us as a couple. One professor, an LDS expatriate, called us the Mormon Battalion. The early 90s were heady times for LDS women with feminist instincts like me and Julie. LDS feminism had reemerged in its fourth wave, and the church had disciplined several prominent LDS feminists. Although Julie and I lived in the same ward, our spiritual odysseys were at different stages. For her, the cycle of spiritual death and rebirth she has beautifully described in her paper was just beginning. Mine was well underway. In the late 80s, I'd encountered the feminist works of Mary Daly, Kate Millett, Susan Faludi, Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza, and quite surprisingly, our own Sonia Johnson. While reading, I experienced profound disappointment as the church's systems and the behavior of its leaders kept validating feminist theory. I despaired as church leaders responded to the feminism of the 1980s and early 90s with a pejorative commentary that misjudged, misconstrued, and misrepresented feminist concerns. In 1992, I allowed myself to be branded a critic of the church when my article, Mormonism's Odd Couple, The Priesthood Motherhood Connection, was published in Maxine Hank's feminist anthology, Women and Authority. Shortly after the book's release, Elder Boyd K. Packer characterized LDS feminists as one of the three great dangers to the church. Thus began my reluctant migration in disgrace to the ward margins. Consequently, while students and professors in the feminist studies class at San Jose State caused Julie profound pain, many of the people Julie referred to in her essay were my emotional life support. They were my midwives as I labored to become a new creature, to emerge from mourning over the loss of my church in a cycle of death and rebirth, identical in pain and scope to Julie's. Nevertheless, San Jose State was not an entirely safe haven for a Mormon feminist. For an assignment in a class on communication theory, I wrote a short and, I thought, objective analysis that included a discussion of how voices reserved for men within the LDS Church. Unbeknownst to me, my essay was distributed to students in a class called Rhetoric and Public Life. An LDS student in the class read the essay, wrote uncomplimentary notes in the margin, and gave a copy to the San Jose State Institute director. The Institute director, whom I knew from having taken classes there, mailed me the student's copy of my essay so that I could read her disdainful marginalia. Along with my essay, he included a letter in which he characterized my carefully worded analysis as lashing out, and also asked me this provocative question. Is it possible that your feminism might come from deep-seated emotional problems stemming from the empty womb syndrome and self-doubts about your gender and homosexual pursuits? Just let me depart a moment from my paper to say that I don't think that the Institute director knew that I had four children and that I'm so heterosexual that during my prime I sometimes had crushes on four different men. So I understand what he was trying to do. He was trying to dismiss what I had written, and he was in a place of pain himself. But thus dismissed is this good brother's, in this good brother's mind, as an emotionally unstable sexual deviant, I learned that San Jose State offered no true sanctuary for a Mormon feminist. Another problem I encountered was a sense that I didn't fit anywhere. Only the Institute director, who regarded me as an apostate, offered me a clear-cut identity. It seemed as if the term Mormon feminist named me, then unnamed me in one fell swoop. When my colleagues learned I was LDS, they assumed I was anti-feminist. When they learned I was a feminist, they assumed I was anti-Mormon. When they learned I wasn't anti-Mormon, they assumed that I'd left the church. When they learned that I hadn't left the church, they disapproved. And on it went, making me feel as if I couldn't be a real scholar, because Mormonism was a cult, not a real religion. I suppose that's like Canada isn't a real country. And I say that because I'm a Canadian, and I should know. Because of this experience, I resonated to Julie's exquisite discomfort in the women's studies class as feminist students and professors challenged and criticized the religion she loved with all her heart. The irony that she was oppressed in a women's studies class in which the prime focus was inclusionary theory and practice is well taken. However, it can be seen from a different perspective from the one she has offered in her essay. And I would say that liberals would not agree with that characterization. I've read the original form of Julie's paper, which was much longer. And in that paper, she used some of the theories that David Horowitz has expressed in his critique of the universities, so where he talks about how liberal professors have dominated the academy and that they often oppress the conservative students, students who have different points of view. And so just with that brief explanation, I'll continue. Julie has argued that the feminist professors and students in her women's study class were hypocritical because they tried to emancipate her from the oppressive patriarchal womb of Mormonism and instead oppressed her in the process. She described feeling smothered in the leftist hegemony of the university that rejected Mormonism even as it claimed to support tolerance and diversity. Julie turned to the work of David Horowitz to put this experience into perspective. Horowitz would say that the discomfort Julie experienced in the feminist classroom arose because the university campuses are dominated by radical leftist ideologues who promote their liberal ideas with religious zeal and crush dissent by harassing conservative students, thus making a mockery of the very diversity and balance, the very free exchange of ideas that they advocate. Julie has tried to make the case that this was the dynamic she encountered at San Jose State as the only conservative religionist in her department. But liberals would disagree with Julie's construction of this dynamic. Henry Giroux, a professor of English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University, has challenged Horowitz's critique of the universities. He has noted that conservative critics of the academy frequently appeal to notions of balance and diversity to suggest that students who have to face troubling questions and ideas are being victimized rather than engaged as thoughtful agents. The fact is, balance and fairness are not the point of pedagogy. The point of critical pedagogy is to encourage students to think independently and critically. And dissent can feel like intolerance and exclusion to students who are deeply invested in certain ideas, but find that they cannot defend them because the arguments they offer in support are not persuasive to that group. Giroux's assessment points to the fact that Mormon culture breeds students who are unprepared for an objective discussion of the church. Many LDS students come to class steeped in Dalinoak's dictum that there is no place in the church for criticism of church leaders, even when that criticism is true. Truth in the true church is not a priority, but something that must be sacrificed to a higher purpose. This is illustrated in a letter addressed to Linda King Newell regarding her carefully researched book on Emma Smith, The Mormon Enigma. Elder Oaks wrote, "My duty as a member of the Council of the Twelve is to protect what is most unique about the LDS Church, namely the authority of the priesthood, testimony regarding the restoration of the gospel, and the divine mission of the Savior. Everything must be sacrificed in order to maintain the integrity of those essential facts. Thus," he says, "if Mormon Enigma reveals information that is detrimental to the reputation of Joseph Smith, then it is necessary to try to limit the influence and that of its influence and that of its authors. Truth surely exists as an absolute, but it cannot be tolerated if it is a challenge to the church." On another occasion, Elder Oaks said, "Our use of truth should be disciplined by other values and constrained by other virtues." The approach to apologetics he expresses in these two quotes is an effort to protect the church by willing the membership into a kind of stupor of thought. It is not fair and balanced, and it also chokes off diversity. It would never be tolerated in an academic arena. I think it is worth considering that the oppression Julie and I encountered as graduate students at San Jose State was not the result of the liberal hegemony described by David Horowitz, but it was caused by the collision of critical pedagogy with the church's current approach to apologetics. I want to close by saying how much I value Julie's paper. The story of this kind of painful clash between Mormon apologetics and critical pedagogy is not a new one, but it is one that really needs to be described, and it has been described very powerfully by Julie in this paper. And on top of that, she doesn't just describe it from an academic point of view. She turns it into a beautiful moral lesson that allows us to expand our love for one another, to forgive each other for our differences, and to truly become one in Christ.
I just have to make one comment. My name is Laura Bush. I'm a lecturer at Arizona State University, and I have to say, Julie, that I think both kinds of experience as someone who is a Mormon and a feminist getting her PhD. I've experienced those kinds of things, and I think that your paper is important, too, to express the kinds of pain that I may put my students through as well, to make that real for people when they come into a critical place in which I'm teaching them to transgress, as bell hooks would say, and how they're able to accommodate that, because I had my own experiences as a young academic, being challenged, being dismissed, being patronized, and all of that. And I think that that is the value of your paper, Julie, is illustrating the pain of that, and someone who is brave enough to confront what you were confronting. And many of our students, especially our Mormon students at Arizona State University, coming into any university setting or any life setting, when they have to confront some of those ways of thinking that they've been taught. So I think that that's the value of paper, and I really appreciate Sonia's response. It's such an interesting case study to have you both at the same university, and I'm really interested in the dialogue that we may have now in response to that. I'd ask each of you to come to the microphone so that your questions or comments are captured on tape. And I didn't mention also make sure your cell phones are turned off. Okay, we didn't get any bad sounds at any point. But if you haven't checked that, I would wish for that. And we have some time now to have some comments and questions for the panelists.
As I was listening to the paper, it occurred to me that what you said was quite obvious. If we're attacked, our natural reaction is survival. And if we're in a vulnerable position, it seems to me that what you're asking for is something quite miraculous. You're asking a lot, but that's it seems to me something necessary, but it seems to be quite difficult to react what would be normally self-defense. How do you react to that?
Yeah, there's no question our knee-jerk reaction is to be defensive, to be angry, and this process, though, does take time. So there are still times when I feel... Well, I'll be honest. When we were here Thursday listening to some people say things, and I'm not criticizing Sunstone people at all, but it hurt me to hear some of the criticisms of the church. And even though for 10 years I've been trying to train myself to be accepting of people on their own terms, when you're talking about things that are so personal to you and to hear somebody criticize it, my still knee-jerk response is anger. And I even whispered to my friend, are you feeling angry like I'm feeling angry? And then I thought, no. You just have to put that aside, and it is a matter of training your mind. This is where it requires discipline and work to think, no, this isn't about me and my feelings. This is about their pain, and their pain is legitimate, and they have a right to be heard, even if it hurts me. Does that answer your question?
I'm sorry I didn't get to hear the whole session. I got detained in the hall. But what I did get to hear, for me, was extremely important. And I think that this dialogue that you're having is a really crucial one. I'm not sure how to state my question, but I think it has to do with this. I don't know if any of you, Laura or Julie or Sonia, have read anything about third world feminism. It's a new branch of feminism that has started in the last 20 years or so. I don't know when it first began. But it starts with the premise that feminism in the past has been dominated by white liberal women of usually, you know, Europe and America, right? And you have women in third world countries who have traditional cultures and religion that they value very much. And often, first world feminists have gone in and tried to liberate these women in these other cultures in with the best of motives, I'm sure, right? The idea that we can see that they are oppressed in some way, and yet it has been very damaging, and you can imagine that women in these other countries resist that. On the other hand, there are women within those cultures themselves that feel that, there are problems within their culture, and they are trying to develop systems that honor these traditional cultures at the same time that they do bring in critical analysis and human rights and other issues from the West. And as I have read in this theory, it has struck me as maybe a little ironic that Mormonism may be a third world feminism, that we're sort of like this subgroup within America. And to me, it represents this tension that I think is very hard, that I don't really know I have the solution to. How can we honor the beliefs of people, and which is part of diversity, which is part of respecting all human rights, at the same time that we may see certain practices that are oppressive, and how do we do that? I don't think that feminism has really come up with a good answer to this yet. When we look at the whole Muslim issue, I mean, there are certainly Muslim feminists, and yet the most effective way is always to work within the inside, that you don't insult the beliefs of those people. So how do we do this? So first of all, my question is, I'm sorry for the long rambling comment, but my question is, you know, have any of you, do you know anything about third world feminism, or do you see maybe any potential here for a way of working through this problem?
Funny you should say mention this, Margaret, because the paper that I wrote that was responded to so vigorously by the LDS student was about that very issue. It had a very small section of it that dealt with the communication situation within the church, in which women had very little voice. It was really about the voids in current Mormon feminism and how we are a worldwide church, and we need to reach out to women in the worldwide church who have very different lives than we do. And I really asked the same question. But I think the conclusion that I came to was at the time I wrote that short paper was that there were no plans that I knew of at the time to reach out to feminists or women in third world countries or European countries, in Asian countries in which Mormon women lived and really knew nothing about Mormon feminism, and not so much to get them to be feminists, but to be Mormon feminists in the sense that Mormonism contains the kernel of feminism with its notion of priesthood for women. What an extraordinary idea to be able to disseminate among other Mormon women. And I ask the same question, how are we going to do that? I think that we need to become very well established to leave a very large body of work to ground us before we're able to go ahead and do that. And certainly this is the time to read up on that problem, and maybe it's one of the next things that Mormon feminists can explore.
I want to make a quick comment because I'm not actually on this panel, but I haven't heard the term third world feminism, but it makes all sorts of sense to me. I know women of color, womanist theory and such. I think that those who are working in diversity, in the issues of diversity, understand this phenomenon, that anyone can be a target and anyone can be a victimizer, so that is actually some theory that can help us consider these issues. I think that what we're talking about here was occurring in the 1990s also, and that's important, that I think that both feminist theory, which really has broadened into gender studies, so that white males can be victims as well, and they were experiencing and defensive in the same ways that I think a Mormon woman might be defensive. So that issues like whiteness studies have grown up to have men explore and look at their own positions within issues of race. And it seems like we can have these kind of theories. This kind of discussion is already going on about what is the experience. And I think that the kind of classroom that I want to create for my own students is a classroom not that's safe, because none of these conversations are really safe, but that's well facilitated and well structured, so that people who are encountering these ideas, who are actually having their worldviews subverted and such, are supported in that conversation. And that as a teacher in that kind of classroom, and I expect, Margaret, you being that kind of teacher, would know the kinds of triggers that are occurring for students like Julie. And I think we've become more sophisticated, at least I would hope that we've become more sophisticated in our conversations in our classrooms and out in the world of feminism, that we don't alienate one another, even as we bring people along and ask them to become critical thinkers and critical of their own lives and their own belief systems. That's what I would be about in my classroom, so that I know I would be aware that I would be triggering students, that I would be being subversive, and I would work to create support structures and theories to address that. And I think that things like whiteness studies and gender studies, in which we validate male experience, that this isn't just about men, women, and that we don't dualize, create binaries that create that kind of you're right, you're wrong context, and that your experience gets invalidated, because I certainly felt that as I worked my own way through being a Mormon feminist and out, even out of the church then too. How was I going to be supported? So I think we had a comment here, Cindy. Paul.
Well, Lori, you just addressed my question very much. I can absolutely relate to both Julie and Sonia's pain, as I did this same experience at Sacramento State, yeah, going through the same kinds of stages of denial and anger and all of those things that Julie described, and came to a different place than both Sonia and Julie. And currently am undergoing the same sort of struggles in the classes that I'm teaching. And so my question to you all three, because we are all teachers at this point, having gone through all of this Mormon feminist pain, how can I, or were there things that your instructors could have done differently to make you feel less attacked, less defensive, less polarized? I'm struggling in my own classes to help my own students who are going through those same things feel more supported, and I would welcome any suggestions from you or Margaret or any of the other teachers that we have here on how I can better facilitate those discussions among my students. And they're not all, I mean, I can spot the Mormons in my class in, 3 seconds, but it's not just the Mormons that are going through that. There's a lot of other religious right students that are going through the same kinds of pain. How can I help them feel less pain than we went through as teacher?
What classes do you teach?
World religion.
Okay. My experience then is a little different. I teach public speaking and argumentation and debate. And I put this even in my syllabus, that you are going to hear things that you don't like to hear in this class, and that this class is about finding your voice, whatever your voice may be. And I tell them up front, the first day of school, that this class isn't about what I think. This is about what they think. And I warn the entire class that just know you aren't going to like things that you hear, but that's the whole great thing about free speech, free thinking, and debate. And so I try to create as safe as environment as possible for all students. And I talk about how I don't even care if, like, they make a case for slavery or a case for Nazism. What I'm concerned is, what kind of evidence do they provide to support their claim? So,
well, the problem that I have is that I've got exactly the opposite going on. The class is not about what they think, about what the students think. It's what the folks in the religions that we're studying think. And I'm trying to get them to not, to be more open-minded and to understand that they're just studying what other people think. Okay. It's not about what the student thinks.
Well, I get that a lot. I teach classes here in the Salt Lake area, and I'd say about 60 or 70% of all my students are LDS. And so I teach critical thinking, philosophy sometimes, and it creates a lot of difficult moments. And we have students who dare to say the most unconscionable things in the classroom. And so usually there's a small group of people that are sort of left-wing in that class, the ones that aren't LDS usually, and then they start going, like that, sort of like, you know, and here you have this person who needs protection because you know exactly how that person is feeling. And so, you know, I have to work really hard to shush that group and say, wait, you'll get your turn later, but every position gets a good hearing in this class. And then I use Socratic dialectic. Rob, how did you come to that feeling? Tell me more about the feelings and experience that cause you to say that. And what I have found is these students are great. They will move through that thought process if you give them enough time, and they will come to a reasonable and conscionable conclusion. And they get to do this in front of the class. And everybody's quite impressed with them. And I think that people are not really these kind of nasty little sound bites that sometimes come out. That's the knee-jerk reaction. There is a thoughtful person in there. And if you can drag that out of a student, you can give them a much better experience in the classroom.
I've been criticized, and I've criticized others. And what I've noticed about our culture, which I think is deteriorating, but not because more people are having more sex, but possibly more people having less sex. But it's because people have such thin skins. I mean, we are always worried about the other person's pain and our pain and all this psychological mumbo jumbo. And the reality is that we never get down to showing how another person is wrong, and we don't allow other people to show us how we're wrong. We block this. Dallin Oaks blocks it by saying what he said on that documentary, which is directly repugnant to the teachings of Jesus Christ when he was on earth. God on earth allowed himself to be criticized, and he strongly criticized his opponents. But it was not an ad hominem attack. Sometimes Jesus' attacks were really bitter, you know, because he, talking to the Pharisees in Solomon's porch, he says, "Children, these children here who hardly understand anything will get into heaven. You won't get in because you don't go in yourselves, you don't let anyone else in." I mean, these are strong words. But the normal response is to try to crucify somebody. Let's kill him. You know, that's the, you know, let's prove that we're right by killing everybody else, verbally or psychologically or spiritually, however. But the reality is what all of this is to call each other to account. And what we have to teach our children, remind ourselves every day, because it hurts. It hurts to be called to account. It hurts to be called to repentance. The sword of truth cuts deep and it hurts. But we have to, instead of striking back, we have to be introspective and think, what the hell is this person trying to tell me that I'm doing wrong, that I can't smell my own bad odor of what I'm doing? And we don't do that very well in Mormonism because we assume that everybody who's criticizing us is anti-Mormon. And it just gets nowhere. And so the calls to repentance are lost. The effect of those to improve and to increase accountability are lost. And I think it's a marvelous thing that teachers like yourselves are attempting to take very thin-skinned students and teach them to develop a little thicker skin and understand that criticism coming their way should be taken by them as an attempt to bring them to account. It's very difficult.
Oh, there's so many things I want to say. How can I do this in 3 minutes so that all... I don't want to protect my students from their pain, in a sense. I want them to actually get it and get on. I really do believe, though, that there's a way in which Julie's journey towards becoming a critical thinker, to becoming more open, was perhaps thwarted and slowed by the context within which her ideas were challenged. And I have this notion that in my classroom, because I've been in classrooms that I felt were more empowering, I've also been in diversity trainings experiences that were more empowering to